From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the early days of rhythm and blues with bandleader and musician Johnny Otis. His hits include the 1958 record Willie and the Hand Jive. He also discovered singers Jackie Wilson, Etta James, and Hank Ballard. Also today, we talk about the stresses of family life with Sue Miller. She's the author of the novels The Good Mother and Family Pictures. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by singer Cassandra Wilson. And TV critic David Bianculli previews The Story Behind the Story. It's a new NBC show that will look at history-making stories from unexplored angles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The South African government said today it wants to grant amnesty to so-called political offenders to improve the climate for negotiations with the country's black nationalists on an end to apartheid. South Africa's justice minister told Parliament that exiles and political prisoners must be allowed to participate in talks aimed at drafting a new power-sharing constitution. The step would appear to bring the South African government closer to resolving one of the issues that were identified at last week's talks with Nelson Mandela's African National Congress. A federal judge in Tampa, Florida, has denied bail to a man accused of conspiring to illegally buy and export Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, allegedly for use by the Colombian Medellin drug cartel. Shoshana Edelberg of member station WUSF reports from Tampa.
FBI agents say Alfredo Tanaka tried to buy 120 Stinger missiles, as well as a large quantity of automatic weapons, to use against Colombian government helicopters. He was arrested Saturday afternoon, as was another suspect in Miami. Federal officials say the Miami suspect told agents he was a close associate of Colombian drug kingpin Pablo Escobar. Both men are charged with conspiring to receive stolen U.S. government property and attempting to illegally export arms. One agent testified that Alfredo Tanaka admitted to these charges after he was arrested and read his rights. A federal magistrate in Tampa has appointed a public defender to represent Tanaka and ordered him detained without bond. For National Public Radio, this is Shoshana Edelberg in Tampa.
Latvia's parliament today elected a pro-independence prime minister. Ivars Gaidmanis, a deputy chairman of the Nationalist Popular Front Party, was elected by a margin of 3-1. At the World Jewish Congress meeting in Berlin, Jewish officials today reported a rise in anti-Semitism in Eastern and Western Europe. Deirdre Berger reports from Berlin.
Congress President Edgar Bronfman said one of the main reasons tens of thousands of Jews are leaving the Soviet Union is because of the rise of anti-Semitism. He said the anti-Semitic organization Pamyat has uniformed gangs roaming the streets that are reminiscent of Nazi troops in the early 30s in Germany. Several Jewish officials today attributed the rise in anti-Semitism to the unstable economic situation in Eastern Europe. Delegates also reported a rise in anti-Semitic incidents the past year in the United Kingdom and France. The conference in Berlin coincides with the 45th anniversary of the end of World War II. It is the first international Jewish event on German soil in more than 60 years. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in West Berlin.
Prices on Wall Street posted their sixth straight advance today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points to close at 2,721.62 in moderate trading of 133 million shares. This is NPR News. The White House said today that President Bush will veto a bill on family and medical leave if it forces larger employers to provide that benefit. The Family and Medical Leave Act would require businesses with 50 or more employees to offer unpaid time off for the care of newborn, newly adopted, or seriously ill children. It would also require unpaid leave for personal health problems and the illness of spouses or parents. White House Chief of Staff John Sununu told business leaders today that the president will veto the measure if the leave provision is mandatory. Government officials and volunteers in central Arkansas worked nonstop today as the swollen Arkansas River continued to rise. Ben Fry with member station KUAR in Little Rock has more.
Residents from Little Rock to Pine Bluff are praying it doesn't rain for the next few days. Crews have been working 24 hours a day to prepare for the crest of the river, which is expected tomorrow in the Little Rock area. Mike Smith, a North Little Rock city engineer, was overseeing work in a low-lying residential district.
if we get fortunate with the rain, we ought to be able to hold this area fairly secure. Starts raining, we'll have to reevaluate everything and see what to do next.
Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton today added Pulaski and Jefferson counties to a list of 27 counties already named as disaster areas. The Pulaski County judge has declared a state of emergency in rural parts of the county because of suspected looting. Over 300 houses have been evacuated thus far, over 180 in the Pine Bluff Jefferson County area, where the river is expected to crest on Wednesday. Ben Fry, Little Rock.
NASA officials said today that the Hubble Space Telescope could take its first picture as early as Friday. Tomorrow, ground controllers are to begin a 36-hour preparation period for the picture-taking process. The process involves sending computer commands that will practice positioning the 12-ton orbiter and focusing the camera. The telescope is orbiting at 380 miles above the Earth. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Johnny Otis has been a rhythm and blues musician, singer, bandleader, songwriter, producer, and talent scout. He started out leading a big band that had the 1945 hit Harlem Nocturne. Soon after, his band, like most of the big bands, broke up for financial reasons. Otis organized a smaller unit that played a hybrid of swing and blues that became known as rhythm and blues. Otis's Rhythm and Blues Caravan became the first R&B touring roadshow. Through his nightclub talent shows and roadshow, Otis discovered such singers as Etta James, Little Esther, Jackie Wilson, Big Mama Thornton, and Hank Ballard. Otis had many R&B hits in the early 50s, and in 1958, his record Willie and the Hand Jive made it to the top 10 of the rock and roll charts. Although Otis is a pioneer of R&B and has played almost exclusively with black performers, he is a white Greek American. Johnny Otis is back in the studio and on the road. The English label Ace Records will release a new recording next month. I spoke with Otis last November, just after Capitol Records reissued his sessions from the 1950s. Let's get started with Otis's first hit, the 1945 recording of Harlem Nocturne. There's a great story behind recording this record. Would you tell it?
Well, this goes back to the mid-40s, and it was my first record date with my own band, as I recall. And we did three things. I went to the producer after we had completed the third one. I said, well, Mr. Rene, that's it. Three songs in 4 hours, and we got plenty of time left. He said, no, you've got that wrong. It's four songs in 3 hours. Now get out there and get another song together. So we were the house band at the Club Alabama on Central Avenue here in L.A. at the time. And I remember when we would play this particular song, the chorus girls and the showgirls would come out of the balcony, out of their dressing rooms and dance on the balcony. And they would always ask us to play it. And I thought it must have some charm. The ladies like it that well. So I said, let's play that. And it was a stock arrangement that had been recorded once before by Ray Noble and an Earl Hagen tune. So, but I slowed it down, and I was a drummer then. I did went boom, boom, boom on the tom-toms, and we recorded it. And the songs that we had done previously with Jimmy Rushin, the great Count Basie singer, and some wonderful arrangements, they didn't do it. But Harlem Nocturne became an instant hit.
And when Harlem Nocturne became an instant hit, then you started touring with Louis Jordan and with the Ink Spots, and they were some of the biggest black acts of the time. Can you describe a little bit what the atmosphere was like at the concerts in which you shared the bill?
Well, both of these people were so popular at the time, having had all these big hit records, that there was that same feeling you feel today before the curtain opens, that great anticipation. They're going to see Bill Kenny and the Ink Spots. They're going to see Louis Jordan. And we were lucky enough to be the band. And, of course, that gave us a lot of help.
Did the audiences assume that you were black?
Of course. In those days, many of the places we played, had they suspected I was white, we would have been arrested.
Well, I remember when I interviewed Solomon Burke, he told a story about how when one of his records crossed over to the country charts, he started getting invitations to play certain places in the South with white crowds who would have never asked him to play if they knew he was black, and he showed up to one of these places, and it was quite a scene. Did anything similar ever happen to you?
No. We're talking now, I assume we're back in the 40s. If we are, it was much different than the Solomon Burke days of the 50s and, or the 60s with Solomon Burke. You see, your life was on the line in those days. When our bus would cross the Mason-Dixon line and the driver would say, well, we just crossed the Mason-Dixon line, a pall would fall over the entire show. We'd all get quiet because we knew we were down there where we had problems. And many times we came close to being hurt. One time we stopped the bus to go to get some gas, and my little singer, little Lester, who was only 13, jumped off and went to the restroom. And I looked up, and there's a guy with a gun in my belly. And he's shaking, and he's all excited because the little black girl went to the white woman's bathroom. And I thought to myself, any death but this. But so she came out, and we went on down the road. But those things happened to us all the time. That was the open version of white racism as against the very subtle, pervasive, and institutionalized version that we have today.
Were in segregated places, were you treated as white or as black when you were traveling with black groups?
In black, as black, there's nothing so unique about a light black person. That's always been the case. And if I'm sitting on the black side having dinner, nobody questions it. He wouldn't be over there if he wasn't black. He ain't crazy, because we'd kill him.
Did you do anything to look more black?
No.
Mm-hmm. Let me play one of the rhythm and blues records from the period that you made, and this was with the singer Little Esther, who we now know as Esther Phillips. And this was Double Crossing Blues. Do you want to say anything about this? You write
well,
the song?
Well, I can give you a little anecdote about it.
Yeah.
I was leaving my little chicken ranch in Watts back in the 40s, and with me were a group of guys I had found at the Barrel House, where I had a nightclub there called the Barrel House. Mm-hmm. And we were going to do their first record, and they became known as the Robins and later the Coasters. But Little Esther was a neighborhood little girl who used to help me with the other children catch my chickens when people would pick out the chicken they wanted. And then we would have refreshments later. And she ran up. She said, Johnny, let me go. So I said, oh, get in. So she got in. We went to Hollywood to the studio. And when we got there, we did the four sides by the Robins, and we had a few minutes left. So I asked the producer, Ralph Bass, I said, man, we got some time. Let me get these kids together. I got a song I think would make sense. He said, well, hurry up. You've only got a couple minutes. So I taught it to him, and we did it, and it was called Double Crossing Blues. And I said, can I do it one more time? Because she kind of giggled. He said, nah, that's it. But anyhow, that became the number one song of 1950, and it brought Little Esther to stardom, and it did an awful lot for us too. And by the way, the bass singer that you will hear on this record is the voice later who became Charlie Brown. How come everybody's always messing with the same guy?
From the Coasters.
He was just a worker at my club, and I noticed he could sing and put him into this group, and he wound up singing on this big hit record with Esther Phillips.
Oh,
Bobby Nunn is his name.
And you're playing Vibes.
Yeah, and I'm playing Vibes.
Okay, here we go.
Been looking for you, Daddy. I just found you in town. You hit some mountain woman and you swore that you were mine. What's the matter, Daddy? Don't my kisses satisfy? If I don't thrill you, baby, goodness knows what I've tried. Folks say that you've been cheating. can't quit you, baby, 'cause I'm so in love with you. What's the matter, Daddy? If you would only tell me why. If I don't thrill you, baby, goodness knows all I've tried.
You stayed out last night, say you were playing cards. Can't understand it, baby, what makes your big fat head so hard. I'm gonna leave.
Johnny Otis is my guest. And by the way, he has a new album of some of his reissued recordings from the 1950s. It's called The Capitol Years. We'll be hearing some of that in just a little while. You discovered a lot of talent, not just a little Esther Phillips. What was your way of scouting for people?
Actually, my first singer was Ernestine Anderson when she was just a little girl.
Really?
And then came Esther Phillips. But after Esther Phillips's amazing success and became the big child star of the African-American community nationally, then everywhere we played, people, they would bring me their sons and their daughters backstage. I guess they figured I was an expert who knew how to make stars out of kids. And that's how it started. One day in Detroit at the Paradise Theater, I asked the manager, I said, during this week that we'll be here, how about me doing a talent show to avoid having to have all these people coming around with their kids? He said, great. And we did. It was to have been 1 hour, but it stretched into 2 hours. And we found so many wonderful singers and players that day. I found Little Willie John, Jackie Wilson, and Hank Ballard and the Midnighters on that particular show. And there were probably others, but the record company I was scouting for, King, only wanted to deal with three at the moment. And I thought, years later, when Berry Gordy formed his great Motown story, I said, no wonder, look at the reservoir of talent here in Detroit.
It must have been funny, though, when the parents were bringing you their children. You must have been exposed to a lot of really untalented kids also.
Well, I learned quick. They would come and say, and they almost all had exactly, and I don't care if I was in Mississippi or Massachusetts, they would say, now, Mr. Otis, we know that you know, and if Junior has any real talent, you'll tell us the truth. And if he doesn't, of course, you'll. But they didn't mean that. I didn't know it. What they meant was, this is the world's answer to the great child star. This is it. And if I would dare to suggest they weren't, then I had an enemy on my hands. So I learned how to sidestep that and tell little fibs.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is rhythm and blues musician and band leader Johnny Otis. His hits have included Willie and the Hand Jive, and he launched the careers of singers such as Jackie Wilson, Etta James, and Big Mama Thornton. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Johnny Otis is my guest. We've been talking about rhythm and blues. When there was the transition between rhythm and blues and rock and roll, did you have to, did you find yourself changing the music, or were maybe the audiences changing that you were playing your music to?
Yeah, that's true. When I was dealing with the classic rhythm and blues that we developed back in the 40s, we did a lot of bluesy material because the black audience demanded it. As the transition occurred and as it developed, we then had to play more animated jump blues, boogie styles, and act, put on an act for white folks because they wanted it to be, well, they wanted to see us, you know, work and sweat, and that's what they liked. The early black audiences wanted a more musical, bluesy, jazz thing. The white audiences wanted that jump tune, boogie-woogie kind of thing. But what a strange thing has happened as the years went by. The roles reversed. Today, our audience for blues-oriented music is white, and the white and the black youngsters are not interested, and that's something that pains us terribly for many reasons, not just personally, but when we start to think from a cultural standpoint, how much we seem to have lost over the past 20 years or so in the African-American community where blues and jazz artistry is concerned.
Well, I want to play a song that you had that was a hit on the rock and roll charts in 1958, and this is Willie and the Hand Jive. Let's play it, and then we'll talk about it. That's Hand Jive, which was a big hit for my guest, Johnny Otis, back in 1958. Tell me about writing the song.
My manager, the late Hal Zeiger and partner back at that time, we had a hit in 57 called Molly's Making Eyes at Me with the great Marie Adams singing, and it became a hit not here in the States, but in Europe. In England, it was number one. So he went over to set up the tour, and when he got back, he said, listen, I saw something interesting. I saw the young people around the London area in the venues where they couldn't dance, the concerts and the theaters. As they sat there, they would do a thing that you guys in the big black bands used to do with their hands, you know, while the band was playing. And they call it Hand Jive. Why don't you write a song called Hand Jive, and maybe we'll do some good over in Europe. Well, I did, and luckily it became a hit everywhere.
So the Hand Jive was basically just kind of clapping and moving your hands.
While you're sitting
in a
dance. But it became a whole dance later.
Well, you know, the Hand Jive is reissued on the the Capitol Years, and inside there's a little insert. Let me see if I can find it.
Yeah, and it's the thing that tells you how to do the Hand Jive dance, and it's all patterned out where you put your feet.
Exactly. Yeah. It tells you like when to do the right hand salute and the left hand salute.
Yeah. I dare you to try to figure it out.
Oh, believe me, I was looking at it before. I thought it would be impossible.
Yeah.
I want to play something that you're featured on from this new reissue called The Capitol Years. And this is Can't You Hear Me Calling?
Okay.
And you're singing on this?
Yeah.
And what are you playing?
After a fashion.
Oh, you sound really good on it.
Oh, well, okay. You and my mother think so.
Okay, well, let's give it a listen.
Can't you hear me calling, baby, 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 please don't go.
Johnny Otis from the Capitol Years. You know, Ben Vaughan wrote the liner notes for this record, and in it he mentions that it was a publicity shot that your goatee was airbrushed out so that you would look less ethnic. What was the story behind that?
Oh, Hal Zeiger, the late Hal Zeiger, God rest his soul, he was my partner at the time, and he did these things without even asking me, and while he wanted me to look less black. He wanted me to look less like a Greek. He wanted me to look like a nice Anglo-Saxon wasp, which is hard to do, but he tried.
So he airbrushed out the goatee.
Yeah. I don't think that sold any records.
Now, your family is Greek? Was Greek?
Yeah.
Your parents?
Yeah. And yeah, we're and are. Yes.
And your last name was Veliotis?
Veliotis.
And when did you change it to Otis?
The kids at school kind of made that decision for me. They decided not to deal with try to remember how to pronounce that. They would say Johnny Otis, and that's the way it stuck.
So I know that your father had a grocery store. Was that in the same neighborhood that you lived in?
Oh, yes. The grocery store was downstairs, and we lived upstairs.
And this was in a black neighborhood?
Yes, in the heart of the black neighborhood.
So that, I guess, helps explain why you grew up with such black
identification. And that's also the luckiest thing that ever happened to me.
Uh-huh. So,
He might, in fact, have put it in a WASP neighborhood. Then what would have happened to me?
Did you not think of yourself as being white when you were growing up?
I didn't think about that at all. I had no concept about that. Luckily, my father was absolutely wonderful in that respect. And my playmates were, I didn't know it then, but they were black, African-American. I thought we were all the same thing. And I don't think it's so unique in America for white kids to grow up with black youngsters and come up together as brothers and sisters. What might be unique is not to veer away. I could not veer away because that's where I wanted to be. Those were my friends. That's where what I loved. It wasn't the music that brought me to the black community. It was the way of life. I felt I was black.
What was it about the way of life?
Everything about it. You know, different cultures have different characteristics. And the characteristics of the African-American community became my own. And I just wasn't willing to give that up to go become part of the mainstream community where people felt superior to black people and they oppressed black people and they practiced democracy and preached racism. I didn't want to be part of that. I want to stay in that sweet, beautiful black place in the black community.
Mm-hmm. So you're spending a lot of time now touring with your band.
Yes.
And you have a new record coming out.
I have two new records coming out.
Ah.
Did you get that record in the mail, the new
good,
one?
Good Lovin', yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, there's a young lady on that record named Ramona who I found recently. And she's in the tradition of Esther Phillips and Etta James and Linda Hopkins and Big Mama Thornton, in as much as I see that she has that indescribable something. She's a big lady. She's young. She's wonderful. And I know she's going to be a star given the correct opportunity.
Well, I wish you the best with the new records, and I thank you very much for talking with us. Johnny Otis's new album, Good Good Loving, will be released in England next month on Ace Records. Here's a song from the album featuring Ramona. This is In the Driver's Seat.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Novelist Sue Miller writes about the stresses of family life. In The Good Mother, the central character loses custody of her child. In Miller's new novel, Family Pictures, an autistic child changes the course of his family's life in unexpected ways. Coming up, Sue Miller talks about the pictures family members have of each other. Cassandra Wilson is a jazz singer, but her new album, Jump World, includes everything from rap to pop. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us what he thinks of Wilson's new directions. And TV critic David Bianculli previews a new news magazine that looks behind the scenes of major news events for the details no one thought to report on. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. NATO Secretary General Verner met with President Bush this morning at the White House about the future of NATO as political change sweeps Eastern Europe. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Verner today again insisted that a united Germany should be a part of NATO, even though the Soviet Union still does not accept that idea. He said NATO is changing its role, moving from confrontation to cooperation in a new security arrangement for Europe, one that envisioned only as much security as necessary for self-defense and stability. But Verner also expressed the view that a united Germany should be a base for nuclear weapons under NATO control, as is now the case in West Germany. However, the NATO Secretary General conceded that there is opposition to nuclear arms in a united Germany from Moscow as well as from the German people. He praised last week's speech by President Bush, in which the president promised to keep nuclear weapons in Europe to help maintain peace. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Officials of both East and West Germany say that they have set July 2nd as the day to eliminate all border controls and provide easy access between the two sides. This announcement comes after local elections in East Germany, in which the Social Democrats emerged as the strongest party in East Berlin. The Social Democrats won 34.3% of the vote in yesterday's balloting. Pope John Paul II is in Mexico on a week-long visit. The country of 85 million people has a majority of Catholics and at the same time a long tradition of separation of church and state. Katie Davis reports that during the second papal visit to Mexico, there are some hints of change.
Today, Pope John Paul II met for more than an hour with the Mexican president, Carlos Salinas de Gortari. The conversation was private, but a press release said the two discussed a range of issues, from Latin America to Eastern Europe. A source close to the president said there was not any overt mention of the relationship between church and state or of a possible resumption of diplomatic ties between Mexico and the Vatican. They have been broken since last century. However, people here are reading President Salinas' warm personal welcome of the Pope yesterday as a significant sign of change. After his meeting with Salinas, the Pope flew in a helicopter to a squatter camp just outside Mexico City, where hundreds of thousands live without basic services, such as garbage collection and drainage. He made an urgent call for the church to deepen its commitment to the people he called the forgotten ones. For National Public Radio, this is Katie Davis in Mexico City.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 11 points to close at 2,721.62 on volume of some 132 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Singer Cassandra Wilson grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, listening to jazz and Motown, but she also studied classical piano. When she was in college, she started performing, singing folk songs and accompanying herself on the guitar. Then she got into the bebop of Charlie Parker and singer Betty Carter and began sitting in at jazz clubs. Wilson's now one of the most successful young singers in jazz, but jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Wilson still likes to mix styles, and music that's hard to pigeonhole can also be hard to market.
On my way, my way, my way, my way, back there again. Back to the warm spot in the middle of your soul.
It's no secret that jazz musicians sometimes take creative direction from their record companies. or that those companies often nudge artists in the direction of pop-oriented music. Singer Cassandra Wilson's previous album was straight-ahead jazz. Her new one dabbles in pop and funk. But this time, the old story has a new twist. The record company wanted her to make the jazz album, and she wanted to make the funky one. But don't congratulate the corporation for altruism or accuse her of selling out. Things aren't quite that simple.
Blue skies looking at me. Nothing but blue skies do I see. My blue birds singing a song. Nothing but blue birds from now on.
Cassandra Wilson's previous album, Blue Skies, a set of standard tunes recorded with an acoustic trio, was Billboard magazine's best-selling jazz album of 1989. It sold a lot better than Wilson's earlier records, which featured her own compositions. She deserved to hit it big. To my ears, she's the best young jazz singer around by far. Blue Skies was conceived by the folks at JMT, the label Wilson records for. It's distributed by the industry mega-giant PolyGram. The record was pretty easy to market, partly because its concept was clear-cut. Young jazz singer shows off her roots by doing classic material. The company would have been happy to have her repeat the formula, but her new album, Jump World, is something else.
Why don't you jump to Jump World? Things jump to another reality. Why don't you jump to Jump World? Things jump into another reality.
Let's go, we don't have much time, but I'ma take you in this rhyme to a place where you can live in bliss. With a groove that moves like this, cause it's...
I'll let you imagine what the folks who got into Wilson because she sings standards are going to make of that. The music she wrote or co-wrote for Jump World ranges from that rap cut to a tender love song and covers a lot of ground in between. Wilson's part of a crowd of young black jazz musicians from Brooklyn, including Steve Coleman and Jerry Allen, who are trying to reconnect jazz with African-American pop music. That's a praiseworthy goal. If you think these musicians are selling out, let me tell you, none of their funk records have gone platinum. Wilson has an edge over most of her Brooklyn comrades because she can write a catchier tune. We'll overlook that rap number, which isn't even good rap.
She moves along the city streets as if no one would dare. Follow the path that she has chosen to take her anyway. She walks beneath the city lights, no other way, until she captures every eye and makes the pavement sway. Woman on the edge, something to behold. Her happiness is simple and clear, like a spot of shade or a bottle.
Cassandra Wilson's song Woman on the Edge is a lot more limber than jazz funk usually is. One thing she gets from the great jazz singers who preceded her is a sense of rhythmic ease. She never tries to slay you, and she never gets shrill. Her voice has a sultry quality she has the good sense to capitalize on.
We speak in separate words. We love in different colors.
In contrast with that love lyric, Jump World includes an old-fashioned protest song called Domination Switch. It takes a swipe at a couple of President Bush's favorite catchphrases.
Kind and gentle, what is that? Some starving, you get fat. You might think 1,000 points of light will save this situation. No. Yeah.
I'd like those funky horn parts. Is Jump World the album that'll break Wilson through to a non-jazz audience? Probably not, but at least it has a shot. Her record company is pushing it, something record companies don't always do with quote-unquote difficult product. But Jump World is proving hard to market, precisely because it jumps all over the place.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Cassandra Wilson's Jump World on the JMT label.
I felt you move beyond the stratosphere. I searched my mind, but couldn't find you there.
This is Fresh Air. Sue Miller's first novel, The Good Mother, generated a lot of debate about whether it's wise for a single mother to seek a romantic relationship and a fulfilling sex life. The best-selling book was adapted into a film that starred Diane Keaton. Miller's new novel, Family Pictures, is also about domestic life. This time, the key event is the birth of an autistic child. Miller traces how the child, Randall, affects the lives of his parents and siblings over the course of 25 years. Jane Smiley reviewed the book in the New York Times and wrote that Miller's focus on a single family reveals much of what there is to know about the American middle class in the middle of our century. I asked Sue Miller why she writes about families.
I think family life is a point at which everyone perhaps is most vulnerable, is one of the most dramatic things to write about in some ways, although day-to-day it often seems the most mundane and the most boring. But it's how people get formed and made, and that's something of great interest to a novelist to record and speculate about fictionally.
Let me ask you to do a short reading from your book, and you could set this up if you'd like.
This passage comes about two-thirds of the way through the book. It's one of the three chapters narrated by Nina, one of the children in this family, and she's talking about a point in her growing up when things shifted in her family and when she and her older brother, Mac, in a sense, both embraced a different identity for themselves. When you read about families like ours, where one member is very ill, special, they're sometimes called now, you discover that often when the problem is removed, because the ill person is sent away or dies or gets cured, someone else in the family takes on that role. And maybe that's all it was, that after Randall left, there was suddenly room for Mac and me to go crazy, to be as mad, as bad as we wanted. On the other hand, maybe we were really only angry at my father for leaving us, acting out, as he would say. Or it could have been just that it was the 60s, and there was a perfect congruence between the times, which heaped its praise on acting out, and our lives. Or maybe it was a result of living in Hyde Park, where being troubled or in trouble was equated with being sensitive and bright, where the high premium put on eccentricity drove half the people my age then and later into a kind of wasteful extravagance of personality. But perhaps it was all more elemental than that, hormones only, singing in our blood, driving us to wildness.
When you were shaping the story of this new novel, why did you want to have, in a way, at the center, an autistic child whose presence changes the life of everybody else in the family?
Well, I mean, that's almost the answer to the question itself. If you're writing a book about a family, you need something that changes the lives of everybody else in the family. And I wanted to have something that I could trace over time, so that I didn't want to choose, let's say, an event like the death of one of the children, like the death of one of the parents, which would, the waters would fold over. But I wanted something that would go on making the characters ask questions of themselves over a long period of time, and particularly for the children as they grew and changed and their allegiances in life truly developed, and they were able finally to ask adult questions about what their experience had been like growing up. So there seemed almost a kind of inevitability to choosing choosing something like the presence of Randall in the family in order to do what I wanted to do fictionally.
The perspective shifts in your novel. Sometimes it's Nina speaking, and the passage you read was one of Nina's. But there are other members of the family who give their versions of the story as well. You seem very interested in how family stories compare within the family, how every person has a slightly different perspective on what has happened to the family and what the motivations for each family member have been.
Yeah. And also, I think I was interested in tracing how one person's response becomes part of the dilemma for the next person. I mean, how there's this whole sort of network that develops and is part of become everyone else's reality becomes part of the reality for someone else, something that the other must respond to, essentially. And I think that's something that's probably gone, generally speaking, from our lives now, and we have so few children. It seems to me one of the remarkable and wonderful things about having a large family is that there's some sort of instructive value in understanding that your perspective is only one of many that could be taken on your parents, on the experience you had growing up. And I think that it's finally, in some ways, I'm sure there are many benefits also to being a single child or one of only two, let's say, but I think one of the real losses in our not having as large families as we used to is that sense that of learning something about the egocentrism of your own perspective on things.
Did your sense of family stories and the function that they serve change from the time you were a child to the time that you were a parent?
That's a really hard question for me to answer since I have only one child, and so his story is the truth as far as he's concerned. I mean, I think that may be in part what has made me interested in that larger family, is the sense that in some way my experience is perhaps a little bit emblematic of the experience of a lot of people. That is, we come from much larger families than we've produced in our own turn. So I'm not sure. I don't really have a sense of how family stories happen now and what they will be like for children when there are only one or two of them.
So there's a sense of if your son is upset by something that he thinks you're responsible for, there's no one to prove him wrong. There's no other child to say, no, that wasn't a problem.
Right.
You're making too much of it.
Right. And he has to struggle with me. I mean, there aren't all alternate versions of his mother for him to look at and think about and to give him some sense of distance from me. I mean, I think it's probably a more difficult thing.
Your novel, A Good Mother, was about a woman who is separated from her husband. She has one child, and she has an affair with another man, and it's a very sexual one. It's one that really arouses her in a way she's never been aroused before. And the book, in a way, raised the question, can a single mother have an imaginative sexual life and remain a responsible mother? At least that's the way that the issue was framed by a lot of people who read it. Was that the question that you wanted to raise?
No. I think that's the question that made it of sort of immediate topical interest to a lot of people who read it. I see the question in both of the novels that I've written as being essentially the same, which is really how do we deal with a difficult, arduous event. In The Good Mother, it was the mother's enforced separation from her child and the sense in which her life was sort of riven at that point. How do we deal with that? What sense do we make of it? Can we, you know, it seemed to me that I was writing a character who in some ways didn't come to grips with a sense of herself, didn't come to understand who she was until that event had happened to her. And in many of the same ways, it seems to me, what I'm doing in this novel, Family Pictures, is exploring the same kind of event among a whole group of people. And for me, both of these sort of surfaces, both of these sets of events really serve as a kind of metaphor for a sort of spiritual journey that I'm tracing various characters taking. So I see to me, the discussion that exists sort of at that level is really about the literal surface of the novel, but isn't talking about the novel's intentions or deeper meanings.
Were you satisfied with the movie version of The Good Mother?
I didn't see it, in part because, well, primarily because I happened to see a couple of previews when I was at other films. And it was just such a shocking experience to see a visualized version of what I lived in a certain way in my own mind that I really realized that I didn't want to have that as a kind of film, literally, through which I'd have to forever see my own creation. That I wanted only to think of what I'd made when I thought of the book and not ever to have a kind of image of what someone else had made of it move across that memory. It seemed to me it might even be, I was actually writing this book still while the movie came out, and I, in some sense or another, thought it might be in some way very dangerous or damaging psychologically and to my own, to myself as a writer, to fool around with that, the way I think about my own work. And I thought at the time, well, maybe after I've finished this, I will, you know, rent the VCR, rent the video of it or something. But I really haven't been tempted, and it wasn't a sort of principled stand that I thought ahead of time I would take. It was just something that suddenly seemed impossible and undesirable to do.
Sue Miller is the author of The Good Mother and the new novel, Family Pictures. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about a visit Linda Wertheimer paid to a very interesting daycare center in Atlanta, Georgia. It's for children of the homeless, and it's a place where the kids stay and have a structured environment while their parents go out and try to find either a place to live or a place to work. We'll also be hearing about the 4+2 talks over the future of a unified Germany, that is, the four victorious allies of the Second World War and the two Germanys, and what the Soviet Union hopes to gain from that process. News of the World Jewish Congress holding its meeting in Berlin, the first time it's ever been held on German soil.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. America's Funniest Home Videos on ABC has been the number one rated show on TV lately. How are the other networks trying to win viewers away? TV critic David Bianculli has a preview of one of NBC's efforts.
The following program contains reenactments of actual events and is not a news broadcast or a news documentary.
What it is an NBC special called The Story Behind the Story. The idea of the show is to take well-known events and explore them from little-known angles. Paul Harvey has done it on radio for decades, telling listeners to stay tuned for the rest of the story. Now it's TV's turn. This Sunday's edition of The Story Behind the Story has features on the man who shot the film of the JFK assassination, the other acts who were on the Ed Sullivan Show the night the Beatles appeared, and the kid who caught Roger Maris's record-breaking home run. Now, obviously, this program is aimed at baby boomers with an appetite for the 60s. The Maris Homer was in 61, the JFK assassination in 63, the Beatles' first American visit in 64. Now, playing to the baby boomer crowd isn't necessarily a bad thing, but what is bad is that this program is so irritatingly incomplete. Take the segment about Abraham Zapruder, the amateur cameraman who caught John F. Kennedy's murder on film. A lot of time is spent recreating the private screenings Zapruder held, mostly for Secret Service agents, before selling the print and TV rights exclusively to Life magazine. It even has former Life Bureau Chief Richard Stolle, who did the negotiating with Zapruder, talk about how noble Zapruder was to sell the rights to Life.
I think the wrong person could have made millions in the worst possible way. He could have sold bits of the film to various publications. He would have exploited it overseas. He could have made an entire movie. The public was mourning Jack Kennedy. They would have paid literally millions of dollars to have seen something like that.
What Stolle doesn't say is that Life, while publishing some frames from the Zapruder film, suppressed others for years for fear that they might be misinterpreted. They also refused for a long time to release the movie for broadcast. And what no one points out is that of the few people who got in to see the Zapruder film at the time, one of them was an enterprising young CBS reporter named Dan Rather. Pieces are missing from other stories, too. The one on the kid who caught the famous home run by Roger Maris, the hit that broke Babe Ruth's regular season record, is the worst offender. It shows news footage of Maris hitting the ball, but cuts to a recreation of the kid catching it. Now, there's no question that the actual film exists. Why not use it? The Beatles segment works the best because it includes a genuine surprise or two, as co-host Jane Wallace explains.
Davy Jones was just 16 years old when he appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show that night, performing as the Artful Dodger from Oliver in a duet with Georgia Brown.
I know that I'd go anywhere for your smile, anywhere for your smile, everywhere I'd sing.
That particular night changed my whole way of thinking around. If I hadn't have been on The Ed Sullivan Show that night and wanted that reaction as much as I did, that I wouldn't have taken part in The Monkees.
This series comes from the producers of Unsolved Mysteries, so it's no surprise that the recreations are so bad or that the reporting is so uneven. But against ABC's America's Funniest Home Videos, NBC will try anything once.
David Bianculli is TV critic for The New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the Spanic Boys, the father and son leaders of a rock and roll band. And we hear about the Million Dollar Quartet, a tape jam session with Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis Presley, and Carl Perkins that's just been released. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.